This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The spy swap is over. The U.S. and Russia exchanged agents in a remote corner of the airport in Vienna on Friday. 4 Russians in prison for spying for the West. 10 Russians who lived in quiet lives undercover in the United States. Also last week, an indictment that explained more about the plot to bomb the New York City subway system last fall. We learned, for one thing, it was part of a much larger conspiracy, and we learned the name of the alleged mastermind. NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been busy on these stories and joins us today to catch us up on what we've learned about Al-Qaeda and about espionage. If you have questions about the subway plot or the spy swap, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. Later on the opinion page, an argument that it's time to stop picking on LeBron. But first, Dina Temple-Raston joins us from our bureau in New York. Dina, as always, nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And I have to begin with news on a group you've reported on, Al-Shabaab, that now claims responsibility for 2 bombs yesterday that killed more than 70 people in Uganda.
Yes, basically what happened is there were either 2 or 3 powerful explosions in 2 venues in Kampala where people were watching the World Cup finals on television. The first place was a rugby club, and the second was an Ethiopian restaurant. And apparently, at least one American was killed. He's a young man who reportedly worked for an aid group called Invisible Children, which is about children soldiers. And their website said his name was Nate Henn, and he was from Wilmington, Delaware, but we haven't received confirmation from the FBI yet that that's indeed who the American who died there. And the Somali militia group, Al-Shabaab, they're the ones who claimed responsibility earlier this morning.
And they are the same group that you've reported extensively on. The case I guess we know the most about was the departure of young men from Minnesota who wound up fighting for Al-Shabaab in Somalia.
That's right. We started reporting about that almost 2 years ago. Some 2 dozen young men left the Minneapolis area and were actually recruited by the group to go and fight in Somalia. And when the recruitment first started, Al-Shabaab was fighting in Somalia against Ethiopian troops that had invaded. And then the Ethiopian troops actually withdrew, and Al-Shabaab started becoming closer to Al-Qaeda and pushing for Somalia to become an Islamic state. And they started fighting the transitional government there. Now, you know, a lot of reporting about these recent bombings is focused on the fact that foreigners were at these 2 venues. But from what I understand from my intelligence sources was that there were a lot of Ethiopians there. And given their longstanding dislike for the Ethiopians, you know, Al-Shabaab was able to essentially send 2 messages at once, one against the Ethiopians and another against Uganda.
And Uganda because?
Well, for several reasons. Uganda has a great number of peacekeepers who are part of the African Union-led force that's in Somalia right now trying to, you know, keep the transitional government in power there. In addition to that, a lot of the transitional government soldiers are trained in Uganda, and that training program is backed by the U.S. and Europe. And then on top of all that, Al-Shabaab has taken on some very strict, almost Taliban-like dictates. For example, it's banned playing soccer in Somalia and banned people from watching the World Cup, saying that it would corrupt good Muslims. So if you put that all together, it goes a long way towards explaining why they chose the targets they did over the weekend.
And this, if correct, would have been, as I understand it, Al-Shabaab's first attack outside of Somalia.
Yeah, technically, I mean, they did an attack a couple of years ago with actually one of the Americans who had left Minneapolis strapped a suicide bomb onto himself, or it was a car bomb, it's a little bit unclear, and drove into a UN building in Somaliland, which technically isn't part of Somalia. It's separate. But this would be the first time that they actually have left the boundaries of Somalia and gone somewhere else to do something like this. And that's made U.S. intelligence concerned, because it seems like a bit of an escalation.
Well, news is still coming in on that more later, Dina, as we learn it. In any case, we're going to focus for the most part on this on the program today on the what we've learned about the Zazi plot and its expansion in terms of the Al-Qaeda plot to bomb New York City subway. We learned that it was expanded to include attacks in Britain, perhaps elsewhere. We've also learned who may have been behind it. But I think a lot of people are still interested interested in the spy swap that was completed at the end of last week. These are the 10 Russian illegals, as they're called, who were found living quiet lives, many of them in American suburbs, and picked up by the FBI just after the departure of Russian President Dmitry Medvedev from a visit with President Obama.
Yes, they looked like they were related, but in fact, they were quite unrelated. The FBI had been watching these 10 people literally for more than a decade, and they'd been watching them meet with various Russian operatives. They'd watched them sort of try to make friends with people who they thought might be able to give them some sort of information. But their assignment was sort of a baggy assignment. The assignment was, go to America, blend in, and then make friends with policymakers or decision makers who might be able to give you information that you could then pass on to Russia. And what it seems like happened over that time was that they really enjoyed their time in America and bought houses in the suburbs and BMWs, but didn't really pass along very much information.
There was, according to the allegations that were revealed in court, a lot of ordinary spycraft, the invisible ink, the passing of briefcases on the street, that sort of thing, buried caches of money. But one thing was missing. There weren't apparently any secrets.
Well, that's right. I mean, right now we have to sort of trust the FBI and the reports that we're hearing from the CIA about whether or not any secrets were passed. But you've got to figure, given that they were only charged with being in this country as foreign agents without registering, that if they had actually passed any secrets, we would have heard about it. But they had this very minimal charge instead of an espionage charge.
We're talking with Dina Temple-Raston, NPR counterterrorism correspondent. If you'd like to join the conversation, either on the spy swap that we're talking about now, or the Zazi case and Al-Qaeda. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. David's on the line calling from West Bridgewater in Massachusetts.
Yeah, I'd like to know what became of any children these people had. It was only briefly mentioned in the beginning of when they first broke the story that some of these folks had children. And nothing more has been said about it.
And I guess some of the children were born here in the United States, Dina.
Yeah,
that's right.
What I was gathering, yeah.
Yeah, some of them
were married or were not married, and what becomes of the children in general. I'll hang up and take any answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Well, there's sort of a mixture of what's going on with the various children. There's one Spanish-language journalist that's here in the United States who was part of this group, and she had a son who has a son who's 17 and another son who's 38. Apparently, they will be given visas to go wherever their mother is, whether she ends up in Russia for good or whether she goes on to her native country, which is Peru. Some of the other children, even before the parents were transferred, were actually sent to Russia to wait for them there. And I think others are working something out to stay with relatives. But, nobody's going into foster care. This has all been worked out very carefully beforehand.
You can only imagine the confusion of these children who were evidently unaware of what their parents were doing.
Exactly.
Okay. As we look at this, though, there were four men who were in prison in Russia for spying for the United States and Britain, and they were part of the swap. First of all, 4 for 10? What's the deal there?
I know from a numbers perspective, it looks like we got shortchanged, but it's actually a lot more significant than that. The four people who came back, who are coming to the West, and they're not all going to end up in the United States, I don't think, were actually pretty high-level people. One was a researcher who had been accused of spying for the UK, and there's some real question as to whether or not he was. Two of them were former Russian military intelligence who were accused of spying for the United States. One of whom was the person who gave the United States the information that led to Alder James, you remember the CIA operative, and also to Robert Hansen, the FBI operative who was spying for the Russians. And then there was a fourth man who was a KGB man. So these were all sort of they'd all been tried and convicted for treason in Russia. There's some question as to whether or not the researcher really did do anything at all. But these other three men, it's pretty assured that they provided some information to the United States. So basically, the U.S. traded four guys who actually did help the U.S. For 10 people who really got it looks like no information. So actually, good trade.
So certainly if they got Hansen and Aldrich Ames, that was at least cutting off two incredibly profitable sources for the Russians.
And long time. I think Robert Hansen was spying for 22 years or something like that.
Here's an email question from Jack in Indiana. Did the 10 people belong to the same social network? Were they friends with each other?
That's a good question. I am not sure that they knew that all of them knew about all of them. You know, I think a couple of them knew of others, but I don't think that they actually interacted. They interacted with other intermediaries that were related to the Russians.
Also, another thing, we've dropped the alleged as part of this spy swap. They pleaded guilty in federal court before they were deported.
The 10?
Yes.
Yes, they actually, it was quite dramatic. They not only pleaded guilty to this lesser charge of being an unregistered foreign agent, but they also, all but one, stood up and gave their actual Russian names, because they'd all taken on sort of normal names like Murphy and things like that. So they sort of stood up and gave their Russian names, and all but one said that they were Russian citizens.
Now, Richard Murphy and Cynthia Murphy were, in fact, Vladimir Guryev and Lydia Guryev. let's see if we get a quick caller. Jay's with us from Albany, Georgia.
Yes, sir. I really enjoy your show, but I wanted to ask you, what happens to all their material? Did we seize their houses and their property? And does this kind of exchange happen as much as it used to back during the Cold War? Because I haven't heard about this in the last 10 years or so.
I think there's a good reason for that, Patina.
Yes, well, this is the biggest exchange since the Cold War. So, no, it doesn't happen too much anymore. And to your first question about what happened to their houses and their BMWs, they now belong to the U.S. government. That was part of the plea deal.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Is it going to be an auction now where you can get a nice house in Montclair, New Jersey?
Perhaps, or a slightly used BMW. Yeah.
Counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston covers terror plots and spy swaps, among other national security issues. More with her in a moment. We're going to be focusing also on the Zazi plot. This was the bus driver from Denver who was has now confessed to a plot to try to blow up New York City's subways, and a part of a plot that was quite international in scope, connected to allegations in Britain and perhaps elsewhere. We'll also learn more about the man who sent them to do their job. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with NPR counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston. She's been covering the U.S.-Russia spy swap. We're also talking about the case in the New York subway terror plot, which grew wider last week. And she's watching the bombing in Uganda with the claim of responsibility by al-Shabaab, the Somali terror group that until now had not launched attacks into other countries. If you have questions about the subway plot or the spy swap, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Let's go to Levi. Levi with us from Buffalo.
Yes, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I just had a question about the terror plot. I'm a law student, and it seems that the information that they were actually delving into seemed to be information that was, something that you can look up through Google searches or news searches, and not something that was incredibly sensitive. A little bit of rationale, a little bit of inferences, and you could have come up with same information that they seem to have been taking. Why is this such a big deal then? Why is all these terror plots? No, not terror plots.
This is the spy plot. Dina Temple-Raston, why the insistence on getting personal information as opposed to open source?
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I have I think what's so popular about the Russian spy swap is that it just sort of sounds so old world or 20th century instead of 21st century. And so people have been sort of fascinated by that. Plus, one of the spies was particularly good looking, and she was on the cover of a lot of different tabloids, and people sort of followed it for that reason. But in terms of strategic importance. I agree with the caller. This is not vital to our strategic importance. 10 people who didn't seem to get much more than Google searches and send them to the Russians.
Levi, thanks very much.
No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. This email from Jackie in Birmingham, England. Why did they wait 10 years? What made them arrest the spies at this time?
Well, there were two things that led them to arrest the spies at this time. One was that one of the spies, one of the Russian spies, her name was Anna Chapman, had actually called her father and said that she thought she'd been compromised. And so there were some questions to whether or not she was going to leave. And then on top of that, they had continually over these 10 years gone back to Moscow to be sort of debriefed. And there was another one of these 10 who was going to going back to Moscow this summer. So the concern was that two of these people were actually going to be gone and they wouldn't be able to hang on to them. So that was part of the motivation for arresting them now.
At this point, the FBI must have a very solid caseload of information about all the spycraft, all the communications techniques, about the way people kept in touch, about who they were keeping in touch with. In a sense, since they weren't getting any great information, doesn't arresting them tell the Russians, well, you've got to change your codes and change your procedures?
You know, it's funny. According to the people that I talked to who were sort of Russian experts and had been following Russian tradecraft in the past, not much has changed about their tradecraft. So I'm not sure that there was a lot new that was discovered, with the exception of there was one thing that they did, that they had sort of private networks. So two computers could pass close by one another mm-hmm. and actually send messages quickly to each other and not be intercepted. And that was new spycraft. But as you said earlier, you know, this is invisible ink and, you know, exchanging briefcases that look the same on escalators and that kind of thing. So my sense of it is that these people had been here so long that to pull them out, you know, you might as well have just left them here and see if they come up with something, given that they were under deep cover for so long. And this was a real vestige of the old Soviet Union as opposed to necessarily the new relationship between the U.S. and Russia.
You know, that passing information one computer to another, there's an app for that. Isn't it called the bump?
I just didn't want to say that out loud.
Okay. Let's go to this is being treated lightly because nobody got hurt and everybody got exchanged, but a much more serious story, an indictment unsealed last week in New York that contains evidence that the plot thwarted last fall to detonate explosives in the New York City subway system was a lot bigger than first believed.
Yes, that's a big deal. And the big deal is that it wasn't just a plot here in New York, but it appears that there were some people who had also trained with Najib Al-Azazi, this Denver area shuttle bus driver who had gone to Pakistan to train in an Al-Qaeda camp. People who had trained with him were actually in the UK, and they were planning something. It's unclear exactly what, and they've only been accused. They haven't admitted to anything, but it looks like they were planning a similar type of attack on shopping centers in Birmingham and or perhaps Manchester. It's unclear.
There were also arrests in Norway.
There were arrests in Norway. Those are unclear, too. It's unclear whether or not there was going to be a separate plot in Norway or whether or not the people in Norway were somehow helping the people in the UK. We haven't really gotten to the bottom of that yet.
And Adnan Shukri Juma, who is he?
Shukri Juma is an interesting guy. He's been on the FBI's most wanted list since 2003. And believe it or not, he actually lived in the United States for a long time. He lived here for about 15 years. He basically had his childhood in Brooklyn and then went to community college in Florida. He speaks fluent English. He looks more sort of South Asian than Arab. Some people think he looks Hispanic, which makes it much easier for him to move around. You know, in Al-Qaeda, we keep ranking people, right? 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. And theoretically now, because the number 3 has been killed, I don't know, about 6 times in the last 2 years.
The life expectancy of a second lieutenant on the Western Front.
Yes. Well, the joke is the people they don't like, they make number 3. Shukri Juma is thought to be number 3. And Shukri Juma, now we knew that Najib Al-Azazi had met with high-ranking al-Qaeda members. We had reported back in October that he'd met with a man named al-Somali, who has since been killed in a drone attack. And it looks like that same meeting that he had with al-Somali, Shukri Juma was there too. So that's pretty high-ranking al-Qaeda operatives who were dealing directly with Najib Ulusazi.
And I've heard you describe him on other NPR programs as Al-Qaeda's Minister of External Affairs, the person who's in charge of, well, sending people out to attack targets in the United States and Britain and other places.
Exactly. But, you know, al-Somali had that role, too. There are a number of people in al-Qaeda who have that role. But here's what makes him different, is that he speaks English fluently. And there are a lot of people who come to al-Qaeda wanting to do something. For example, Neil Bryant Vinius, who was a Long Island kid who got all the way in the inside of al-Qaeda and then came back to the United States. These are people who don't necessarily speak Arabic. So having a person of that high rank who understands America, has lived here, and speaks English is a dangerous thing.
Here's an email question from Kent in Conifer, Colorado. So Najib Ulusazi from my home city of Denver has confessed to being a terrorist, after Guantanamo Bay and Bagram Air Base torture tactics, his words. How can we trust any confession reported by the U.S. government?
Well, he has a plea agreement, and he had a lawyer, and he was essentially not put into some secret court system, but in fact was tried in the or was going to be tried in the civilian court system before he came to this agreement. So I think as these things go, this was fairly transparent. And honestly, we found out within a day or two of his actually being identified before he was arrested. We'd found out through sources of ours that he almost immediately admitted to getting some sort of explosives training with al-Qaeda. And, you know, they check out these stories because often these people say they were with a particular person and they weren't. They were just sort of self-aggrandizing. And his stories all checked out. So as far as being dubious, maybe the Najib Ulusazi is not the greatest one to be dubious about, because this one seems pretty transparent.
Well, there is seemingly a pattern, not just him, but the alleged Times Square bomber, now confessed Times Square bomber, excuse me, and the man who tried to set off the bomb on the plane over Detroit on Christmas Day, all pleaded guilty to very serious charges. You would think, I'm just speculating here, but perhaps part of the mission is if you're caught, plead innocent and have a show trial. Get a lot of publicity. You see all the problems that the World Trade Center bombing trials are causing.
Yes, yes. I mean, I can see how you get there, but more fundamentally on the ground, what you have are young men who want to prove that what they had been assigned to do, they intended to do it. They didn't chicken out. So in the case of the young man who had explosives in his underwear, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, who tried to set this explosive off over the Detroit skies on Christmas Day. He started talking as soon as he was picked up by authorities. He started saying he had been trained by al-Qaeda. And my understanding from people who have talked to him directly in law enforcement, they've said he was really worried that people thought that somehow he'd lost his nerve and that's why it didn't work. And you know, to get to the point of being a suicide bomber, you really have to sort of psych yourself up for that. And when it doesn't work, you know, you're very upset that it didn't work.
One other question about the Zazi case, as I remember some of your reporting on this, there were a number of suicide vests or equipment for suicide vests that were recovered. Did he have Confederates?
Well, it's unclear what exactly what was recovered was not vests, but there were some backpacks. And you know, when you find backpacks and timers in an apartment of somebody who says he had explosives training, that makes you quite nervous. What I've heard most recently from my intelligence sources is that those backpacks were actually supposed to be flown to Pakistan and were perfectly innocent. They couldn't find any sort of explanation for why there were 16 backpacks. But of course, when they found 16 backpacks, they were very worried that he had 16 Confederates, as you say. Mm. As it turns out, it looks like he had two. There is one who Addis Madajanin, and now the other name is escaping me. And one has pleaded guilty to going and training in the camps, and the other is waiting for trial.
Let's go next to Travis. Travis calling us from Baker City in Oregon.
Yeah, hi, thank you. I don't mean to get too far off topic, but I had a question about the bombings in Uganda. I was wondering what the implications might be that al-Shabaab is now apparently operating on an international level, and also if they have any other vendettas in the wider African community, and I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thank you, Travis.
Al-Shabaab's kind of grumpy with a lot of people right now, not just Uganda, because the African Union forces there are a combination of a number of different African soldiers. In addition to that, the real concern in this country is that, as I said earlier, there were some two dozen young Somali Americans who went from Minneapolis to Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab. And the concern has always been that they might come back, they get training, come back, and attack here in the United States. And the one sort of buffer against that sort of thought was al-Shabaab has never really done anything overseas. It's got so much on its plate in Somalia trying to overthrow the transitional government. The hopeful thought was that they would just stay there. And the fact that they haven't, and they broadened that out. And again, this has something to do with the fight in Somalia attacking Uganda. But the fact that they've broadened that out very much worries people.
What other countries have troops in Somalia as part of the African peacekeeping force?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think now. I think I think Rwanda has some forces there. There's some Kenya has some forces there. So it's a Ethiopia has some forces there. So all that brought together, I think, makes for lots of enemies al-Shabaab could point out if it wanted to.
Dina Temple-Rast, an NPR counterterrorism correspondent. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Diane. Diane with us from St. Augustine, Florida.
Hi, Neil. My question is, do we have any idea how many American citizens are currently incarcerated in Russia accused of spying? Thank you very much, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Diana, we should note the four people who came on our side of the swap were all Russian citizens arrested for spying for the United States and for Britain. But Dina?
Yes, well, that's a great question. As far as we understand, there aren't any Americans there in jail for spying, which is one of the reasons why we got four Russians.
Let's go next to Sam. Sam with us from Denver.
Hi. I'd like to go back to that spy swap and make this comment. The people that were traded back to the USSR, it all looks so innocent and superficial, et cetera. But, you know, we're talking about spying here. Is there something that we might not be saying? Either side or both sides?
It's a good question, Sam, but it's not the USSR anymore. It's Russia. Dina?
Sure.
Well, you know, we only know what they've told us, but I guess you have to assume that if they spent 10 years of surveillance on these people and they actually got something, that they would have charged them with it. And they didn't. I mean, very often these spy cases end up with some giant trade. I mean, what we're used to seeing in the Cold War era is, you know, the bridge and the spies from our mm-hmm. side and the spies from their side trading places. And we saw something a little more high tech with the two planes sort of landing together in Vienna and a little van carrying them back and forth and then taking off 10 minutes apart. I think if there was something more here, I do think that we would have heard about it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thanks
You're
for the
welcome.
Call, Sam. Email from Nancy in Underhill, Vermont. Could you please explain the immigration status of these people? How did they get here? Did they overstay visas? Did they have green cards? Where did they get their Social Security numbers?
In some cases, they did have residency permits. I can't break them up one by one, but I know that they were not overstaying visas.
In some cases, they had taken over identities of people who had died.
In one case, I know that for sure. Yes, there was a birth certificate that was related to someone who was already dead.
Getting back to the Nazi case, when the arrest was made, was the threat of subway bombings already apparent? Did that surface afterwards?
Before he was arrested, yes, mm-hmm. they knew there was some plot against what they thought were transportation targets in New York. Before he'd actually come to New York, he drove cross country from Denver to New York at high speeds, and they were already tapping his phone by that time. They already were a little worried that he had tested explosives, and their concern was that he was driving cross country because he had the explosives in the back of his car. That's why he was stopped on the George Washington Bridge before he came into New York.
And we may have time for one last question. This is Richard calling from San Francisco.
Yes, first I had a quick compliment for your guest. When the Sazi case broke, I compared her reporting to a lot of different people, and I found her to be the most thorough, the most accurate, the least biased of all of them, and it led me to read her book on the Lackawanna, whatever number it was.
It's hard to tell on the radio, but she's blushing.
Oh, good. My real question was from her insight and everything, and she could give us some insight as to the importance of pursuing al-Qaeda in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. One of the arguments being that it is so decentralized that people can learn to make bombs and whatever all over the world, and that it's not really worth the military effort there. And I just wondered how important those so-called training camps were in either the Northwest Territories or in...
And I don't mean to cut you short, Richard, but we've got 20 seconds for Dina Ant to answer that.
To say quickly, the training camps, such as what exists now, are very important. We did a story a couple of weeks ago about how hard it really is to make a homemade bomb, and it's incredibly hard. I know everyone says you can just do it by getting instructions on the web. Apparently, you can't. And so these training camps give them hands-on experience to do this, and they need to be stopped.
And I think they are very important targets. Some are in places that can't be attacked. But Dina Temple-Raston, thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Dina Temple-Raston joined us from our bureau in New York. More on the story from Uganda later today. This is NPR News.